From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Darrell Jones is free after serving 32 years in prison.
Whatever can be gained back at this point, you also have to look at losses. And while I was away, my grandmother, who basically raised me, you know, my only brother, they died.
Also today, should Harvard have rescinded admission to a student who made racist comments?
I'm extremely sorry for it, and I wish I could have taken it back, but I can't. And I know that forgiveness isn't given, it's earned. The person who wrote those things is not who I am today.
And after a racist incident, is the MFA's celebration of Juneteenth a moment of truth for the city?
I do hope that folks see Juneteenth as an authentic space, and I hope they do come.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Darrell Jones spent 32 years of a life sentence in Massachusetts prisons for the 1985 murder of Guillermo Rodriguez. From the time he was convicted at age 18, Jones has always maintained he did not commit the crime. In 2017, his conviction was overturned after a judge ruled he didn't receive a fair trial, but in April, a judge allowed prosecutors to pursue a new trial. That retrial concluded last week. And the verdict?
Where the defendant is charged with the crime of murder, is he guilty or not guilty?
Not guilty.
Now, at age 52, Darrell Jones is finally a free man. He joined us in the studio earlier today, and he says he's still taking it all in.
Standing at the post, you know, and waiting for that decision is just a flashback to what happened before. So that's the hump I'm trying to get over, that feeling. It's a chilling feeling when you're just risking your life, because I know the words natural life. And so just being back in that situation, it was a little chilling.
In this retrial, the jury took about 2 hours.
Yeah.
What was going through your head during those 2 hours? And as you had to stand and await a verdict again in this case, what was going through your mind? How did that feel? I imagine no one can imagine it if they haven't experienced it.
Yeah, it's... You know, my mind was just thinking the gamble, right? You know, I'm standing for my principle. I'm standing for what I know I didn't do. I'm standing for what I know is right. And I felt like that was the way to expose them. That's why I didn't take their deals, because I'm saying I have to go all the way for the next guy or the next woman that's in Framingham or wherever. I have to do it. But it's hard when you realize that behind you is your sister and, you know, and your girl and different people and... you know, family and friends and my dad. I'm thinking about them. You know, that's all I could think about was, did I just put them in a situation to be separated again from them because I have to go through this? But I think they understood. I just had to. I couldn't let it go. I thought about it in prison too long, you know, and new trial was the way to go. They did it to me in secret in the past. And people didn't know I was there. And I think that's one of the issues. No one knows that we're there until we end up in the situation of getting out. And it was important to me that it was public. I didn't think it was going to be like it was in Plymouth and all of that.
You mean as public as it
was? No, it wasn't
that
it was going to be as public, that they were going to be as nasty and as, you know, and spiteful and move it all away from where it's been for 30-something years, 32 and more years. It's always been in Brockton. And the court proceedings, the appeal, everything, and then throw me out to Plymouth and try to put me in a situation where I can't pick juries of color. You know, if you look at the statistics, you'll realize that Brockton had the biggest pool of people to pull from, yet and still they weren't having a lot of people from Brockton at all. And they definitely wasn't having people of color. So, you know, I come from a mixed family, so I understand, you know, I don't have a cultural issue, but seeing what they were doing, I realized that that's how they were thinking.
Did you feel then that the system was being deliberately stacked against you a second time after clear evidence? I mean, your first trial was eventually thrown out because of, you know, police falsifying evidence and a detective lying and a weak case and a racially biased jury. So you felt like that deck was being stacked against you again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to trial when the original trial itself is a jury that came back two times, couldn't decide, you know, stuck there, even with the racial bias that went on, even knowing that there were people there that said he's black, he did it anyway, even before they started. That whole scenario was tragic, you know, and watching the way that they carried it out, you know, all the avenues that they used and the denials from the judge to everything my lawyers were doing, that was a great job. I couldn't believe I was even back in court. You understand? I couldn't believe it because no one's ever identified me. It's only an identification case, and no one ever identified me. The police know I'm standing right there in front of these witnesses right when they open the bar and we step out. So I know they know what we know, and they know more. So they know it's not me.
You've said in the past that while it wasn't a death sentence, you were sent there to die. It was the equivalent of experiencing a death sentence. So what did you think about someday hoping to get out? Did you fantasize about things you would do when you were free again? Were there things that you hoped could be a part of your life in the future? What role did hope play during that time? And do you have plans for any of those things now?
Well, you know, you can have all the hope in the world, but you have to understand what that feeling is like. You know, whatever my hopes are or whatever, you know, can be gained back at this point, you also have to look at losses. And while I was away, my grandmother, who basically raised me, you know, my only brother, they died, you know.
They died
a week apart. So both of them in the hospital at the same time. And then when you can't go to their funerals, I lose them, not there for them, can't hold them. And then in 2008, my son dies, and I can't go to the funeral. So I'm not there for him. It, you know, I was caught into that. So there was no time to think about what I want to do. It was all traumatic time, you know, and then you're dealing with the prison system and, you know, the guards, and I'm trying to build programs in there. There was just so many difficulties. That's all I know, you know, rough terrains.
What kind of programs were you trying to build while you were in prison?
Well, I was fortunate enough. We did, you know, Beyond the Wall. And so I made the first video from that prison system to be able to outreach to kids along with other guys, you know, Mac Hudson and, you know, just Ricky McGee and just good people, right? Mark Thomas. And I was able to get other lifers, you know, Herbie, list of people. I would like to name them all, you know, and, you know, to be able to make this video to come out here to talk to kids. So we made the video. That was major for me. And, you know, I actually was able to make two albums from the prison, not through the prison, but through the phone, and What's Beautiful Never Dies and Obama Answer This, where groups of artists out here got on those albums. And actually, the I was talking about it because I didn't pay attention to it in prison. I know now, winning a United Nations award for the Obama Answer This. So I'm sitting in prison getting a United Nations award.
Incredible.
And it didn't even dawn on me that, because I wasn't in it for that. And then having, you know, the AAC programs and different programs. I was the chairman at Norfolk, you know, for the African Americans. And it was different things to be done in there. But hope-wise, I just believed in God. I just believed that it could not always be this way, that he wouldn't allow it to be that way.
You've been out fully free for 6 days.
For 6 days, yeah.
And what comes next? How do you think about this open time in front of you now?
Well, my commitment has to be priority to be with my son, you know, that's here, and be with my other son, and to enjoy the community, you know, enjoy my family, and you know, and enjoy the life that I'm having, you know, and the little man Doug in my life, you know, new people in my life, right? And, you know, and having, you know, a woman in your life and all these things to adjust to. But I have to first, along with that, focus on where I was and how many people I know, you know, too personally, that shouldn't be in jail. And I think it's important that I have to follow up on things that I envision, like Do Your Homework Media. I speak about that because WBUR played a major role in investigating my case, Bruce Gellerman, you know, and so did WGBH, Jennifer McKim. But there's so many medias that didn't follow up. And although I've been on those shows, you know, many shows, 5, 4, all those things, and I've, you know, been in all those papers for projects that I did in prison, I didn't really talk about what was happening to me because I wanted to do the projects. But I realized that the media...
So you felt like you couldn't bring your own case forward because you needed this focus to be on the projects.
Yeah, because that was important to me. And I didn't think they were interested, you know, in trying. So I was just doing the appeals until, like I said, Bruce Gellerman and we met and we, you know, we talked and he started following up and looking at what I was saying.
What would you say to the media outlets now that were interested in the programs you were running while you were in prison, but that you have said showed no interest about why you were there and whether you should be there? What's the message to journalists and media outlets about how and where they should be paying attention?
Well, I consider them to be aftermath specialists, meaning they come through our communities, right? If a shooting happened, and they will hunt a family down, they will knock on your door, they will bother you, and then they forget. Or they choose not to follow up. So I've learned now firsthand, even through this case, even on some of the major ones that I've been on, and I intend to put that out there, that I've been on, and they've run different things on me. I've been on there more than once and twice and three times, right? Channel 4, all of them. And then I go through this process, and you don't appear, right? And you don't say anything. Hey, that guy that we had on here before, he's out. He's innocent. You know what I mean? This is what's happening. And I think, who would do that? And I'm thinking, if you're a media, you'd want the public to know who's back, what's going on, and as well as want them to know the issues that are happening in Massachusetts. I'm not the only one that got out. And just this, we got seven of us out in just a matter of 2 or 3 years and innocent, and they're out here now. And you're not even following up. So you, other states are doing it. If you watch the Central Park Five that's going on now, I got a chance to spend time with Corey and him, you know, in Atlanta. We just left in April. And now you see the way they see us, and you look at that and you say, these other states are following up. The media is following up. You see every day somebody getting out innocent. It's almost as if Massachusetts is keeping it a secret to say, hey, we have that problem too. We're locking up innocent men and women, but we're keeping it low. And what honest media would want to prevent the public from knowing about that? I have a problem with that. And I think to only show up when it benefits you and to only put out the issues when it benefits you is a abuse of our community.
The Central Park Five were five young men who were wrongly convicted of rape in New York a number of years ago. You met with them in Atlanta. Yeah. What was it like to meet those men?
Well, being in the same situation, they just happened to have that situation. I was 18, too, and they were a little younger, some of them. So meeting them was like, wow, same story. You know what I mean? And same malicious prosecutions. So it was wonderful meeting them and hanging out and exchanging, you know, a little bit of knowledge about each other. But it's even more wonderful to see the film that they have on Netflix, how they see us. And I recommend everybody watches that because
this is the Ava
that
DuVernay
is happening.
Film.
Yes, that is happening here. So my thing is to expose what happened to them in order to get it over here.
You turned down two plea deals, one offered each time you went to trial.
Yeah.
The Central Park Five were arguably coerced into false confessions. It seems like in both of those circumstances, we're seeing a system that can easily channel people into guiltiness regardless of their innocence and into participating in the system in order to obtain relief or a shorter sentence or to get out of the situation. Does that really underscore holes in our criminal justice system? And what do you think we can do about that?
Well, one, it shows unaccountability. I understand there have to be police. I lived in a place where I met everybody from Aaron Hernandez on all the way back. So I've met the guys that come to prison, the worst of the worst, and the guys that did do it. And they say everybody says they didn't do it. That's not true. There are guys that'll just tell you they did it, and they're just there forever, and they don't care. So I respect that we have to have police because who was going to protect my family or little sisters or whoever? And good police should separate themselves from bad police. And I'm looking at it saying, okay, there's good police. Then you're accountable to say, I'm not that bad apple. Speak out. You know what I mean? And prosecutors, you have to say, I'm not that prosecutor. You don't represent us. You understand? And they're not. And the accountability from our leaders is to hold them accountable, to be able to watch for that, to be able to see how many bad cops have done this to people, who they are, how long they were in position to do it, and then you can start studying how they do it. But no one's doing that. No one's doing the homework.
Durrell, you're able to seek $1 million in compensation from Massachusetts for false imprisonment and potentially even more in federal court. Are you going to go after that or other forms of redress or accountability?
Of course. Of course. I mean, that's my recourse. And if it was up to me, I also plan to pursue the perjury on officers involved and would like to see lawsuits against them as well because they caused the action.
You know, your wrongful conviction wasn't just a failure of criminal justice, but also a racially prejudiced society. What would you like to see change, both in terms of where we are on race in our country right now and where that intersects with the criminal justice system?
Well, the racism is a foolish act because there are white women, white guys, you know what I mean? There are just all cultures. The racism factors is something that we allow by not uniting understanding that this is about poor people. This is about giving people jobs where they can control people's lives and they don't care the color. And it's identifying them, their racism. The cultural systematic racism is different than a people's racism.
You are a black man. When you went into prison 32 years ago as an 18-year-old, you went in as a young black man.
Correct.
You have come out in a different world 32 years later.
Without doubt.
You have come out as a black man.
Right.
Are you experiencing the world differently? Has it changed around you when it comes to race and your experience as a black man in our larger communities?
Well, sadly, you know, coming out here, what I realize is that the people out here are incarcerated. They just don't see the wall around them. They don't see the fence around them. They don't see that they're caught up in the prison system because the prison system kind of functions like this.
Disattachment, what do you mean by like this?
Disattachment, right? Judgments, a lot of hate for each other. You look at the Trump situation. You look at all of it. A lot of hate. That's what happens in there. That's the functioning world in there. To come out here and see people functioning the same way and this many years later, it's a sad state to me because at least I know where I was. There's so many advancements that could be occurring in the world and unity, and it's like a setback. It's painful. It reminds me of prison.
There's a listener out there who's hearing a story from you today that they'd like to believe doesn't really happen, mm-hmm. that they'd like to believe couldn't be possible. Hopefully you've awakened compassion, empathy, outrage, awareness. What would be your last message of action to listeners who are moved by your story and what you experienced?
The Not In My Name movement is the example that I give. Things are happening in your name. When I went to prison, it was Commonwealth versus Durrell Jones. And when the DA gets up, what she talks about is, I'm Jessica McKinney and I represent the Commonwealth. So she represents you, your husband, your family, my family, and she's doing whatever she wants to do. And the public has to say, not in my name, because as I use the example, if someone was running around with a picture of you robbing stores or raping, whatever they were doing, and they always wore a T-shirt with your picture on it, you would call somebody, station or whatever, and be like, I don't know that person. So in this state, the district attorney can't convict because they want to. They have to do it in behalf of the Commonwealth. And I think it's a responsibility of the Commonwealth to start calling these DA's office and say, stop doing that in my name. I don't want that done in my name. And so that's important to me, to create that movement that they have accountability. The courtrooms are supposed to be public. I think we need to have court video cameras in the courtrooms and it be online where you
televised can, courts.
Where people, that's right, where people can watch cases because it's in your name. So you have the right to, where people can watch cases and say, I see what's going on here. And until we're watching, it's never going to change.
Durrell Jones is a free man after being found not guilty in a retrial of a murder for which he served 32 years in prison. Durrell, thank you for joining us here today on Radio
Thank you
Boston.
Very much for having me.
Durrell Jones will share more of his story at WBUR City Space on July 11th. There's more information at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to talk now about Kyle Kashuv and Harvard. And listeners, this conversation will include content that's difficult to hear. Kashuv survived the terrible high school shooting in Parkland, Florida last year. And in the aftermath, he turned his experience into conservative activism. He also got admitted to Harvard. But yesterday, Kashuv revealed on Twitter that the university has rescinded his admission over racist comments he wrote months before the shooting when he was 16 years old. In one comment, he used the N-word 11 times and wrote, "Kill all the bleeping Jews." Here he is on Fox News last night.
I'm extremely sorry for it, and I wish I could have taken it back, but I can't. All I can do right now is seek to right this wrong. And I know that forgiveness isn't given, it's earned. And I know that, you know, the person who wrote those things is not who I am today.
Joining us to talk about this is Reverend Mariama White Hammond. She's pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here.
Also joining us is Michael Nitzel. He's president emeritus of Missouri State University. He's a clinical psychologist and a former policy advisor to Governor Jay Nixon. He wrote about this for Forbes. Michael Nitzel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, we want to invite you into the conversation. What do you make of this decision? Did Harvard make the right call in rescinding admission to Kyle Kashuv for his comments, or should Harvard have accepted his apology? Can and should college students be held accountable for their past behavior? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. Now, I should note that we reached out to both Harvard and Kyle Kashuv. Harvard said that as a matter of policy, they do not comment on the admission status of individual applicants. Kyle Kashuv did not respond to our request to join us or to comment. Let me start with both of you and just ask you, what are your initial reactions to this story? Michael, maybe you go first.
Well, I thought, of course, it was a compelling story in terms of another example of the culture wars that universities have been embroiled in recently. To get to a bottom line opinion on it, I thought Harvard did the right thing in rescinding the offer of admission to Mr. Kashuv. And I think that the primary justifications I've seen for why Harvard should have allowed him to continue, I didn't find convincing. And I think that in a closer look at the case, I understand why Harvard did what it did.
And Reverend Mariama, what's your initial reaction to the story? Where do you find yourself focusing?
Well, I am a black minister, and so in many ways I felt my feelings about race coming into conflict with my feelings about grace. Both of those things, I think, are important. I think where I sort of landed, and that, you know, I've tried to sort of look at this young man, and it's hard to know. I mean, the reality is that he is asking for grace, and my question then, you know, that's a larger conversation I think we need to have as a society. And then my question is, was he the kind of person that was extending that to other people? Because I guess if I was in the position of the admissions officer, I think this is a hard call. I think they had the right to do it whichever direction they chose. But if he has demonstrated an ability to do that to others, I might take it more seriously about doing it back to him. And it's just hard for me, based on what I've seen so far, to see if that's who he was.
Yeah. You know, the whole situation is really challenging. Over in the New York Times today, David Brooks wrote of the decision, "Is there no such thing as privacy or being underage?" Michael, what's your response to that?
Well, of course, there is such a thing as privacy and being underage. I'm not sure that 16 qualifies, however. Much of what Brooks and others have said seems to be premised on the idea that he was young and that his actions should be viewed in that light, that there's a mitigation because he was 16. First of all, 16 and 17 are the years in which colleges look at students' behavior and achievements and make a decision about whether to admit them or not. That's the data you have, is how does the person behave when they're 16 and 17. Second, society has decided that serious crimes committed by someone as young as 15 or 16 can be prosecuted as they can be prosecuted as adults. They do not retain necessarily the benefits of the juvenile justice system when the offense is that serious. So I understand that David Brooks was calling for Harvard to engage in the moral education of Mr. Kashuv, and that he called for them to engage in a restoration of the heart. I don't know if that's Harvard's responsibility, and I don't think it was irresponsible or irrational of Harvard to decide, based on everything that it knew, that that wasn't a task that it wanted to broach with this particular individual.
Listeners, what is Harvard's responsibility and what is Kyle Kashuv's responsibility? Call us and share your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed from Westboro is on the line. Ed, what's on your mind?
No, I just wanted to agree with Harvard's decision. I think, especially at somebody who is 16 years old, to make comments like that, that's kind of ingrained in their personality, and you could say you're going to change, but I think that's racist behavior, and either it's learned from parents or whatever, but I don't think you just say, I'm a changed person, and go along with that.
Thanks for that, Evan. Reverend Mariama, I want to play some more tape to Ed's point from Kyle Kashuv's interview on Fox News last night.
Look, what I said is indefensible and wrong, and I apologize for repeatedly. But what's also in that same message is I use anti-Semitic jokes. And I basically pray every week. I'm Jewish. My parents are Jewish. They immigrated from Israel. Half my family was wiped out in the Holocaust. So clearly, that's not indicative of who I am. I'm Jewish.
Right.
And I'm not anti-Semitic at all.
So there's a lot I want to unpack here. And we've had several different people make comments about who he really is. Reverend Mariama, does a person get a pass for saying offensive things about a member group to which they belong? And does the fact that as a Jewish young man he made anti-Semitic remarks automatically mean that his racist remarks weren't serious or real?
I mean, I think it does say to me, to some extent, that you're just being irresponsible with language, period. You know, as somebody who used to run a youth program, I'm going to be honest that I've heard young people do this, and I've had to call them out on it, and I've had to hold them accountable for it. I think, you know, what's challenging for me, so there's what's going on with him as a young person, and like as I said, as someone, I actually have advocated for young people to be considered young people honestly through their early 20s. The challenge that I have is, some of the people coming to his defense are not people I remember standing aside beside me when I was doing that on behalf of other young people that I think they are easily demonized. And so I think what's challenging in here is, if we want to be a society that's about grace, let's be it, and let's be it for everyone. If we're not that kind of society, and if you've advocated for a society where some people are held deeply accountable, then you can't come forward and then advocate on behalf of this young man and say that it's unfair. And so I do think, you know, the fact that he's Jewish, the fact that he made that, I mean, I personally want to understand how you could make that statement as a descendant of a family that lost members in the Holocaust. I think there's some deeper unpacking that needs to be done about how he got to that point. But I think this is partially about him, and it's also a lot about us and about who we are and who we want to be. And I just want us to be consistent, because I've seen a lack of grace on even younger kids of color. I've seen, you know, a lack of grace on people whose names we can't pronounce. I've seen a lack of grace in other instances And so if that's who we're going to be, then he should take the same consequences. If we're going to be about grace, then let's be about grace consistently.
You know, I admit I was struck by this conversation of forgiveness we're having in this case of privilege compared with the struggle to get acceptance for, let's say, approaches like restorative justice when vulnerable young people or people of color offend in harmful ways. So I hear you, Reverend Mariama, that this idea, we either believe in forgiveness or we don't. And if we do, then we believe in forgiving everyone in their, you know, their moments of growth and development. Michael, let me ask you, one of the things that Reverend Mariama said was she has seen young people do these things. Young people sometimes just do dumb things. And some are expressing skepticism that Kashuv has grown and matured. But isn't there room for growth and maturity and redemption from that in a young person?
Oh, certainly. And, you know, I think that particularly, I believe men look back and feel very fortunate that they might have escaped some of the stupid things we did as adolescents, where we are particularly prone to impulsive and risky and often aggressive behavior. So clearly there is a "there but the grace of God go I" reaction that many adults will have to this. But Kashuv chose race as the dimension to reveal his, or to demonstrate what he called his outrageous comments and his excessive comments, which he said they were sort of competing to demonstrate. He chose race, and I don't understand really how his reference here just recently to the anti-Semitic comments as jokes argues very much in his favor. It is not a joke to say, let's kill the effing Jews. And I don't see how the animus is relieved from that comment by being Jewish yourself. If anything, it seems to me it's an aggravation of it. So, yes, I think it's extremely important. I agree with the Reverend about the importance of forgiveness and the fact that youth probably deserve extra doses of it because of the dumb ways we behave when we're young. But this seems to me to go a step beyond that.
I'd like to bring in a couple of callers here, Michael.
Yeah.
Natasha from West Roxbury, tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. I just think that Harvard's liability is a major thing to consider here. I mean, I think I understand completely and completely agree about grace in general, but I think a child who's been exposed to violence in school and has this history of aggression and prejudice is quite a liability on campus. And then Harvard cares a lot about what their graduates do. It's made very public when somebody does something big from Harvard. And what is it going to look like if in 10 years or 20 years down the line he's doing something extreme, whether it be gun violence itself or like pro-gun and anti-Semitic and racist things?
Thanks for that, Natasha. I want to add Patty from Framingham here. Patty, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think it's a little bit hypocritical to come down too hard on this kid. I know how deeply ingrained racism is in our culture, and it would be a lie to say otherwise. And people have been making jokes for since the beginning, before this country even started or when it started. So he apologized. He knows it was wrong. And I think he deserves a break, even though I do recognize it's Harvard's prerogative to rescind the admission. I think they should rethink that.
Michael, Patty says, you know, he apologized, he knows he was wrong, give him a break. In college admissions, in your experience, what role does and should morality and moral character play in that decision-making process?
Well, again, I think admissions officers try to look at these cases on an individual basis. Certainly, as you know, and I'm sure as your listeners know, Harvard has done this before. They have dropped individuals whom they had accepted because of plagiarism, because of sexist comments, in one case because of criminal conduct. There is a line, I think, across which behavior may go, where a college decides this is not the type of individual that we want to bring on campus. They view it as a risk. One of your callers already referred to that. They view it as a potential threat to other students, and they view it as being inconsistent with the kind of quality of classroom and interaction they want to have on campus. So I think that there are occasions in which that behavior can be extreme enough that it's quite a legitimate aspect for an admissions decision to be based on.
And I think we need to be honest about the fact that to some extent, there are many good schools in America, but Harvard is seen as a sort of top-of-the-line prize school to get into. And I'm pretty sure that he will find a place to go to school. I think the question is, you know, for the thousands of other students that they rejected, does he deserve a space over those other students? And so I think that that's some of the tension in this, when you are not taking everyone, when you're not saying, you know, everyone that's qualified, we're going to let in, because there are tons of qualified students that got rejected. And so I think, you know, we do want to recognize that there's a long waiting list. And so to decide that he maybe doesn't deserve a spot over someone else who's on the waiting list is sort of the situation that they're in. And it's, I have no doubt that he will end up somewhere. Question is, should he go to a preeminent institution?
So to Reverend Mariama's point, you know, admission is not a right. It is Harvard's prerogative. And we've been talking really specifically about this case with Kyle Kashuv. In our little bit of remaining time, I got to believe that part of what's haunting any listener about this story is the idea that people can be held accountable for things they said in stupidity earlier in their lives. There seems to be an emerging collective fear that our digital, you know, trace now creates an opportunity for us to just never be able to grow and never be able to be forgiven. So just parting thoughts on that. Where is the space for moving forward here? This is an experience that increasingly people are going to have at different degrees of harm and different degrees of poor judgment, I recognize. But what's the path forward? Just in a few seconds each. Michael, please.
Well, I think that's a terrific question, and I don't have a good answer for you as to where to draw the line in general. But in specific cases, I think universities, other institutions will have to do a careful job of looking at the specific instance and trying to make the best decision they can on that. But it is that's a very thorny question.
Yeah. Reverend Mariama?
I mean, I personally believe that we should do a better job allowing people to remove social media. But I also will tell, I mean, I think to this young person, as I say to other young people, words do matter when they mean something. And before you say something, make sure that you really mean it. Now, unfortunately, that could go all the way up to the top of our leadership that's not being followed. But that is what I advise my young people, and I think that that is something that all of us should be thinking much more about.
Well, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
And Michael Nitzel, President Emeritus of Missouri State University, a clinical psychologist and former policy advisor to Governor Jay Nixon, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. And tomorrow is Juneteenth, also known as Juneteenth Independence Day. And that's a holiday that celebrates the end of slavery in the United States. Juneteenth refers to June 19, 1865, but it wasn't until 2007 that Massachusetts first recognized the holiday. New Hampshire officially recognized the day for the first time last year. As Renee Graham writes in the Boston Globe, in a nation where there are official state holidays for treason and ignominious defeat, Juneteenth deserves far more recognition. Joining me now is Renee Graham. She's a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Tiziana.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Renee, briefly remind us about the history of Juneteenth. Why is this day significant to American history?
It marks the day in June of 1865 when a Union Army general named Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, and issued an order emancipating the last of the enslaved people who were there. Because Texas was so far away, they essentially held out for 2 years after Abraham Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. So that news only arrived in Texas in June of 1865, after the Civil War had ended.
Almost 3 years later. When did African Americans begin to really recognize this as their Independence Day, Renee?
Really in the 1980s. I think what happened sort of earlier before that was that people were really reticent in sort of talking about slavery and dealing with slavery, and that included the African-American community as well. I think in the 1980s, especially coming after Roots, which I think was very important, people
this
began
the,
to look
the
at that
television
history.
Television miniseries, Roots. Is that what you
the
mean?
The landmark television series about the Middle Passage and slavery in America.
Mm-hmm.
I think people really began to reevaluate that history and embrace it in a very different kind of way. And one of the things that people started to do was have Juneteenth celebrations on June 19th.
So to your point about the 1980s, Texas was the first state to designate the day a holiday. That was in 1980. And there are only 46, well, there are 46 out of 50 states, which 46 is great, but it's not 50. So what message do you think it sends to African Americans in the U.S., not only that it's taken time, you know, as late as last year to get states to adopt Juneteenth Independence Day, but also that not all the states have done so yet?
Well, you know, it's twofold. Not all states have done it yet, but it's also not a holiday, a state holiday, in the way that we think about it being a state holiday. You know, offices aren't closed. There's no suspension of mail delivery. Schools aren't closed. It's not that kind of holiday. So in a weird way, it's kind of like states got to do it without putting any real skin in the game and saying this is the day we're literally putting aside to observe what happened in 1865. Having said that, there are states who haven't even bothered to do that. You know, I think that's where we are now, where there are still these holdout states that refuse to acknowledge it in any way.
Renee, in your piece, you compare Juneteenth celebration to D-Day and Pride Month celebrations. You say all are about freedom, yet it will receive the least attention. And that means another opportunity is lost for this nation to wrestle honestly with its legacy. Honestly with its legacy of slavery. Tell us more about that.
You know, if you look at what we are observing this month, and, you know, it's very hard to miss all the Pride celebrations. Boston's was a few weeks ago, and the bigger celebration is coming up in New York at the end of the month to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the modern LGBTQ movement. We saw all the commemorations of D-Day in early June, and, you know, getting together people who were there who landed on the beaches of Normandy. And all what, you know, the subtext of all this is about freedom. It's about the fight for freedom. So is Juneteenth. But I would venture that the average person, if you talk to the street, the average white person doesn't even know what Juneteenth is. They've probably never heard of it because it doesn't get that much attention. African-American communities celebrate it, but it doesn't get much attention beyond that.
One of the lines that really stood out in your op-ed says, Juneteenth is too much of a reminder of this nation's festering sins to be venerated in a country that likes its history noble and sanitized. Do we have to come to grips in a much more deeper and dirtier way with our history of slavery in order to make room for Juneteenth to be honored the way it should be?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, it's without question. I mean, you're talking, you know, over 150 years since the end of the Civil War, and there is still this kind of this reticence, this deep marrow, deep reticence in this country to talk about slavery, and not just about what happened for those, you know, centuries past, but how it continues, the repercussions impact every institution and everything that happens today. You know, the racism we deal with today is the remnant of slavery. And so if you don't deal with that, you can't talk about what's happening today, and we still haven't developed the kind of dialogue we need in this country around what happened with slavery, what happened with Reconstruction and Jim Crow, and everything that came after that. And I think what happens is because Juneteenth at its core is about emancipation and about the end of slavery, people just don't want to talk about it. Because to talk about the end of slavery, you have to talk about slavery. And we still, in this nation, for the most part, we just aren't there. We weren't there, you know, 30 years ago. And in some ways, we're probably farther away from it even now because of the current administration.
Renee, I want to bring another voice into this conversation. Malia Lazu is the founder of the Urban Labs, and she runs a Juneteenth commemoration in collaboration with the MFA. Hello, Malia.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks, and thanks for joining us. I want to bring you in here. You've been helping spearhead the MFA's Juneteenth celebration for the past 7 years. Tell us how you got connected with the MFA and why you wanted initially to host the celebration there all those years ago.
Definitely. So we had been working on really helping Boston shift its culture through an effort called the Future Boston Alliance. And we were working a lot with Black artists from Boston, which also, I should say, tend to be not necessarily just African American, but, you know, a lot of diasporatic artists. And we, you know, and they were really pushing for an entry into the MFA. And here's a museum that is world renowned, that sits in Roxbury, that very few people who live in Roxbury feel welcome or had access to. So it was a local artist named James Pierre who approached me to see if we would put something like this together for the MFA. And so we don't have it. I mean, this year it happens to be on June 19th, but we have it around June 19th, and we try to have it every year on a Wednesday so that the museum is free so everyone can come in.
So I have to ask, Malia, as someone who's worked with the MFA for years now and planning this Juneteenth celebration, what was your reaction to hearing about the racist experience that a group of students had there last month? They said they were racially profiled and harassed during a school trip to the MFA.
Well, yeah, we found that out because they were actually supposed to be one of our openers for Juneteenth, the Davis Academy. And so we found out what had happened through the Davis Academy when we were working out their contract. And it, you know, it's a very, very hard position to be in, you know, to be having the Juneteenth celebration for 7 years, having invited Davis Academy to be a part, and now have that, you know, that sort of unraveling. But rightly so. You know, we did not start doing this work with a museum because we thought they were woke. We started doing this work with a museum because we thought that African Americans and Black people have a place in the museum. And the more that we take that space, the more we'll probably see you know, racial incidents until people at all levels of the museum, including their patrons, get the message. So I wasn't surprised at all. I was definitely encouraged to see how the MFA responds, and I hope that the MFA doubles down and continues to do work in the community, you know, with communities that it says it wants to feel welcome in the museum.
And I do want to note that we reached out to the MFA's Chief of Learning and Community Engagement, but the museum said that due to two ongoing investigations, MFA personnel are not able to speak about the incident or about related topics. There has been some discussion in Boston's Black community about the upcoming celebration at the MFA. Adrian Walker, who is another Boston Globe columnist, wrote that tomorrow's celebration now looms as a litmus test for both the museum and the city. And Destiny Polk, who is set to appear on a panel at the MFA's event tomorrow, spoke with WBUR's Amelia Mason about her thoughts.
Any Black person who was asked to do this celebration before the racist incident kind of blew up is probably feeling similar feelings of like, now I have to choose to side with a community that feels really hurt. Or do I still show up, you know, for this event that is meaningful but maybe more questionable now?
Malia, what's your reaction to hearing that?
So my reaction to hearing that is that it's true. I mean, I have to say that we've been doing this for 7 years. Last year we had almost 5,000 people, and we never got any press around Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. And now I've been called daily to talk about Juneteenth. So it is a really unfortunate position to be in as someone who has been working with the museum for 7 years to help have a start to integration. And, you know, I myself see this as a learning moment. But I also understand that we're not a monolith, and that some people are going to, you know, want to
no longer come to the MFA, and you know, that's their right to do so. I am happy that folks like Sheena Collier did the Boys in the Hood movie earlier this week. We're going to be doing Juneteenth. Most of our artists who have been a part of Juneteenth for the last 7 years have gone back to the museum as, you know, paid curated artists for the late night parties or other things. So I think, you know, relationship building is slow, and allies, when they're learning how to be allies, mess up. And it's up to, you know, every individual whether you want to give the generosity of interpretation to the museum.
Renee, in just a few seconds, is there anything you'd like to add? Any last thoughts?
You know, I just think it's important for people to see Juneteenth not just as this African American celebration, but as this quintessentially American holiday that looks at the potential of freedom in this country for everyone. That's why I see Juneteenth as our real Independence Day.
And that's Renee Graham. She's a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Thanks, Renee.
Thank you.
And Malia Lazou, founder of the Urban Labs, who runs the Juneteenth commemoration in collaboration with the MFA. Thank you, Malia.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.